In the Farm Commercial Code, probably would be applied. 3305, 3306.
Because I think it was clear that prior to the passage of the code, courts had held that executed sales of credit were in the nature of cash, and checks couldn't be stopped. New York, the highest court in New York held that, and that case, while has never been overturned, the Supreme Court of the state of Washington held that. I believe, Your Honor, as the Court of Appeals in Dallas pointed out, there was an old Court of Appeals case here in Texas that reached the same conclusion regarding a bank draft drawn by one bank on another that was given as payment for some fees in a food store case. And the court there held that you couldn't stop payment on that instrument. Again, using the executed sale of credit rationale and saying that those are the parties that have to be liable on the check. The New York cases immediately after the adoption of the Uniform Commercial Code followed the same reasoning and held that the teller's check was not subject to a stop payment order. Now, there have been some later New York cases that have criticized that result. I think the petitioners certainly cite those cases. But none of them they reach a different result. One of them doesn't give any analysis. The Clean case, which is the latest case, it's a two-paragraph opinion that says there's a fact issue here, send it back and try it. One of those cases simply says that in the Fur Fantastic case, it says, if the remitter is not a party, then you can't stop payment. Well, the remitter is not a party in either of these cases. In that case, the remitter was both remitter and payee. Here, in these cases, the remitter is the remitter, the one who purchased the check. The drawer is the savings and loan. The payee, in our case, was the Horseshoe Operating Company, ICC, in the other case. Your Honor, I think that the court has to look at two things in making its determination here. One, what have the courts in Texas done with negotiable instruments similar to this? And two, what are the purpose of these checks? Why are they issued? What are they used for? And how does that comport with the Uniform Commercial Code and the Transaction of Commerce in the state of Texas? I believe, Your Honor, that the analysis and the argument that we've proposed here comports with what the code states are its underlying purposes and policies, one of which is to promote the continued expansion of commercial practice through custom and usage. Section 1102B2 of the code. Your Honor, with my remaining time, I'd like to just address very briefly the...
How did you all split your time?
I'm supposed to take 13 minutes.
I'm sure
there are 8 minutes remaining.
Oh, I'm just a light. I'm sorry. I will defer to Mr. Cronzer. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm sure the court is pleased to know I only have 8 minutes. I guess one of the first things that I should note, that is, I don't know whether it's an error or I misspoke or what you want to call it, but at several places in the most recent brief I filed, I referred to Petrolife, which is the party to the underlying transaction, as a remitter. And they're not technically a remitter. They're not shown on this draft at all. This draft could as well have been issued by a university without, on their own, for some purpose of their own. There is no remitter as such, and for that reason, Petrolife does not have a claim to the instrument itself, which makes a very material difference in response to the questions you propounded, Judge Hess. The argument has been made that because the changes in the UCC with respect to what a customer, when it was adopted, that a customer, if there's another bank that it's drawing on, that makes it a customer. And as a customer, it can stop payment. if in fact it has not been honored by the drawee bank prior to the attempt to dishonor. Now, in this case, the court might have some interest when you look at the checks. And I don't know if you can see them. I couldn't see the federal one. But the Federal Home Loan Bank did, in fact, honor. The drawee did. But they had to solve it to pass before our bank could then take the credit, and they got it stopped. But you see here, Federal Home Pay Any Bank, Pay Any Bank. Right? So we don't even have the reason here to distinguish between cashier's checks and this type of check.
Why didn't you just sue the Federal Home Loan Bank to collect on the check? Why didn't you just sue the Federal Home Loan Bank to collect on the check?
Well, Judge, I hope we have misperceived the reasons. We didn't want to mess around with them in the federal court. That's we thought we had a good, solid citizen to pay at that time. It may be. They have the perfect legal defense. Everybody in the case, non est pluribus unum. Everybody's in bankruptcy. Everybody's broken. Everybody's picked up. But let me do this much. Assume these premises. Assume that ICC is not a holder in due course. The court appeal said that's a fact issue. We don't waive that, but assume that. Assume further that because of the language, even though it's the Federal Home Loan Bank, that they would have a right to stop payment, that is, University City. And that's, where are we? And that's the question, what difference does it make? Well, the difference it makes is in, and this is where we have our major difference, because the real issue in this case is should a check of this type be given a more credit in the market, law merchants, than a simple check of a customer? When people don't want the check of the customer, then you're down hard to it. That's the only reason you have cashier's check, money orders, and official checks of institutions. There's nothing in the UCC about that. It's just done to protect the way people deal with those transactions. That's it. And that's what we say. This type of bank issued by the lending institution, its purpose was precisely the same. And it's artificial to say it shouldn't carry with it the mail just because there's another bank, which ordinarily is the case when you're talking about $2 million checks insofar as savings are concerned, Mr. Chief Justice. That's the reason you get it away from their own issuance. But now if you will just look again at the language of 3.306, right, the one not holding. Unless he has the right to the holder in due course, any person takes the instrument subject to. And the defense, this is the controlling section, 4. The defense that he or a person through whom he holds the instrument acquired it by theft, or that payment or satisfaction to such holder would be inconsistent with the terms of a restrictive endorsement. The claim of any third person to the instrument, that Petrolife doesn't have. It has no claim to the instrument. It is not otherwise available as a defense to any party liable thereon. Petrolife is not liable. Unless the third person himself defenses the actions of such party. That was also reshaped when the UCC was promulgated and accepted in Texas, so as to accommodate the customer language in the other section that we're talking about. When you read the comments under this, you'll see all of them say that there cannot be an intervention or an assertion of the defenses either by the drawer or by the remitter or by somebody arranging for it, unless it's a claim to the title to the instrument. That was and is known as the principles of jus tertii, and the very law review articles they have cited, they're contained in our brief, state exactly what we stand before you today. No claim can be asserted in that suit, even if the stop order is effective, that is not a claim to the title to the instrument unless it's theft, and we don't have that.
Is this an area in which your case is different than the horseshoe case?
Judge, in our case, we have the claim of a third party in the proceeding, that is, Petrolife. And I don't know how they had the university satisfied they were going to protect him if there was a claim made. As the Court of Appeals said, and as the record shows, they just had a revolving line of credit. And for some reason, determined before it could even clear the bank, determined not to honor it, and they, even though it had been marked paid by the Federal Home Bank, they somehow intercepted it, headed it off at the pass. The only difference that makes is, doesn't the drawer university savings remain liable, and can anybody get in that suit? And that raises the final question upon which you didn't grant the writ, and that is, are our general rules of parties, joinder of causes, and the matter of intervention, should they destroy the legitimacy of this claim on the paper itself and confound the litigation with the underneath litigation between the parties that can ensue? And all I want to conclude with this, if I may. This is what the only article that I know that's ever been written on teller's checks as such. That's the Columbia Law Review article cited in all the opinions. There is an article that will be published in the Texas Tech Law Review. It's referenced in our last effort. It's not yet published, but it essentially holds that payment can be stopped. That's the principle of that, but it doesn't deal with these. But these jus terci defenses are dealt with in the Columbia Law Review. And I know it's not wise to read generally, but because I think it's so appropriate to this issue and this type of a instrument, as well as any of the others, where payment is in fact stopped either voluntarily or through notice of adverse claim, the drawer faces the prospect of a suit on the instrument by the payee or holder. May I conclude this reading?
You may.
Thank you. In the case of the payee who is not a holder in due course, the drawer may assert the claim of any third person to the instrument as a defense, if that person defends the action for the drawer. The language of Section 3.306D apparently encompasses only the assertion of the third person's claims of ownership, to the exclusion of mere contract defenses. That restriction prevailed at common law. Moreover, the comment to Section 3.306D cites a number of examples, all of which involve claims of title. While the language of Section 3.306D requires that result, restricting jus terci to claims of ownership is unfortunate. I'm not saying they don't suggest that it's unfortunate that you can't mix the two together. But the loss of the quickness, the speed of these transactions, when somebody says, I'm not going to take a check from you and gets launched, I want it from a bank or a cashier's check or a similar check. We sincerely believe this court it's not an obligation. I know there's 900 gorillas up here. Can do what you want, but we feel it's a true basis to protecting the law of merchants. And let the parties have their litigation in the bankruptcy court or somewhere else, but not to impair and impede the enforceability of these transactions. Thank you for giving me the extra time, Mr. Chief.
Any questions? Thank you.
I would like to ask you one question at the inception. If I walked into Guaranty Federal Savings and Loan and said, I am in a contract situation, I need a check, and the buyer will not accept my personal check, what is the highest form of bank check that I can purchase? Would it be an official check?
Your Honor, after the Depository Institutions Monetary Control Act, savings and loans can now issue cashier's checks. That's the highest obligation.
1985, what would be the highest kind of check I could purchase?
Well, that act, I believe, was 84. I believe you could have purchased a cashier's check.
A cashier's check meaning one that was drawn on the savings itself.
Drawn on the savings and loan itself.
When Guaranty Federal issued this check in question, was there an immediate offset to the credit balance of Guaranty Federal and savings and loan? In other words, did they debit your account, the bank where you had the funds on deposit?
Your Honor, as to Guaranty Federal, I do not know the answer to that, but suppose that there was an immediate debit to the account. That still is not an acceptance. It cannot be because of the definition of acceptance in Code Section 3410. That section makes it clear that first only the drawee can accept, and remember our petitioners are the drawers. Second, that code section makes it clear that the acceptance must be by signing on the instrument itself. And that debit would not have been any signature on the instrument by the drawee. So it could not have been an acceptance.
Now, endorsement canceled means the same thing as stop payment, correct?
Well, close. The endorsement was canceled because they stopped payment, Your Honor.
If you look at the Guaranty Federal Savings and Loan form, which is exhibit number 5, it says stop payments will only be accepted if the original check is returned or if the stop payment order is signed by all parties. Could you explain that to us?
What they're trying to do, Your Honor, is to slow the instance of stop payments discouraging their depositor remitters from coming in and trying to stop them. But that does not tie their own hands if they decide to override their internal policies and go ahead and stop the payment when they're asked to do so.
Let me ask you a question. On that same exhibit 5, Guaranty Savings Bank official check application, it said font type cash. On the face of it, it would mean that $900,000 was deposited, and therefore you issued a check contemporaneously. You know what I'm going to have reference to?
I don't remember the exhibit, Your Honor. That was not a case on which I originally consulted, but and I don't want to step on my colleague's toes on that one, but my impression is that that a check drawn on a bank at Malakoff was brought in, deposited, and then the teller's check was drawn from a debit to that account in which this check had been deposited.
In an ordinary situation, if a drawer issues a check and does not stop payment on it for whatever reason, let's say the drawee is insolvent, so neither the payee nor the drawer is concerned about the drawee paying the instrument, all right? Does the issuance or non-issuance of a stop payment order affect the drawer's liability on the instrument?
It really does not, Your Honor. The drawer makes a contract to honor it if, upon presentment, it is dishonored. Being a contract, it's one to which contract defenses are admissible. That's what our whole argument is about. I'd like to make just a couple of other points, if I may, Your Honor. First, as to this argument based on a part of Section 3306, that we don't have a claim, or that Petrolife does not have a claim, that is simply not correct. Now, I would like to show you what is right here in 3306, what is left out in 1. It is that unless you're a holder in due course, you take it subject to all valid claims on the part of any person. Petrolife is a person. Petrolife has a claim like this. It had purchased the check from us. It turned the check over to ICC based on fraudulent misrepresentations. There's law in Texas for generations that fraud vitiates transactions. Fraud vitiates deliveries of deeds. Well, the fraud, which we've established for summary judgment purposes, would vitiate the delivery. And that means that Petrolife still has its title. It has equitable title, and the right, when it establishes it on a trial, to recover the actual legal title to that instrument with which it parted only as a result of the fraud. That's certainly a claim which fits within the statute. Furthermore, Your Honor, that statute does not say precisely what Mr. Kronzer suggested. That statute does not directly say that only claims can be asserted. It says you take subject to claim, but it does not say only claims can be asserted. And it would certainly be premature to decide that until it's determined what the evidence is at trial. Now, a few other things I'd like to suggest. By the way, on this point, the Fulton case decided in Georgia, and which is on very similar facts, and which goes with us entirely, is an excellent case, which I commend to your honor's attention. Let me talk about the difference between teller's checks and cashier's checks again. There is a difference. It's a very clear difference in the way the code functionally defines the obligations of the parties on these, and it's a difference that matters. Teller's checks are basically the personal checks of the institutions which issue them. They have to have some way, for example, they have to have some way to pay their bills to their creditors. They typically do that by drawing a teller's check rather than by issuing, for example, a cashier's check. They have to have some way to do that, and they're clearly like the personal checks when you look at the UCC's functional definitions of the obligations of the parties. And it's the cashier's check that's the highest form or type of a check that these institutions could issue.
What is the charge for issuing a cashier's check?
Well, it's very low. It's usually just a couple of bucks, $2 or $3, Your Honor.
It was a teller's check.
Generally, yes, it's a very low charge for issuing these. The reason the charge is not higher, it's just an administrative charge, because typically the money's taken out of the depositor's account as they're issued. So it's just a low administrative charge.
Would that be the same reason for the low charge in the teller's check?
As far as I know, Your Honor, it's the same. There is a low administrative charge. It's fairly low overhead to issue. Fairly low overhead to process them. Your Honor, there has been some talk about the public expectations. Let me suggest that the public expects to be able to stop payment on checks in instances like this, such as Petrolax, where they believe they've been defrauded. And I believe that's an important consideration. There was a question, Justice Phillips, about the history of this, about what was the case prior to the UCC. Mr. Kronzer referred to a law review note, a student note in 67 Columbia Law Review. I would encourage you all to read that. It's a good note. I do not agree with that student's conclusion that only claims are admissible under 3306, but remember, as I've already suggested, we've got a claim anyway. We've clearly got a claim. But my point is, even that note will point out that prior to the Uniform Commercial Code, the majority of courts permitted stoppage of payment on teller checks. It's not like banks could not stop payment and raise defenses prior to the Uniform Commercial Code. Also, I'd like to point out that Petrolife's a remitter. You don't have to be shown on the check to be a remitter. If you go in and turn your funds over to the bank to purchase the check, you are functionally the remitter on that check. Nor does this statute limit us only to claims or defenses of the remitter. It doesn't say that. And on the question of the endorsement by the Federal Home Loan Bank on the back of that check, they simply do what all banks do. They process them first, including having them stamped. They make actual decisions as to payment after their machine process. That's why it was first stamped and then that was taken off. But had they paid it, we'd be discharged anyway under 3802.
Why on Exhibit 8 did you put stop payment on cashier's check? if it were a teller search.
I assume, Your Honor, that that is a stamp.
No, it's handwritten.
Is it handwritten? I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. Which case is that an exhibit?
This is guaranteed federal savings.
Your Honor, I don't know what was in the minds of those bank officials when they did that. But cases like this shouldn't be decided on the basis of what's in the minds of the bank officials. You can look to a clear statute to see what the legal aspects and obligations are. I'll be happy to answer further questions, but I don't want to tread on my counsel's toes by taking any more time.
There's one part of the guaranteed federal check that says notice to customer. None of us have a copy where it's legible, and we cannot read the small print.
I'll have to defer to Ms. Greenberg, Your Honor, and see if she has a copy where it's legible, because I must say I don't either. Thank you for your courtesy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Justice Cook, but I don't think I have a copy on me where it's legible. However, I might be able to remember what it says by looking at it.
It says notice to customer.
Yes, the purchase of something which is covered over by a stamp will be required before this perhaps instrument will be replaced or refunded in the event it is lost, misplaced, or stolen. And then it says underneath that to Citibank, New York, N.A. I believe that the notice should be given to Citibank, New York, which is the drawee on this check. There's a couple of questions that have come up that I want to address really briefly. Justice Spears, I believe you were concerned with whether the illegality defense could prevail even on a cashier's check. And Mr. Griffin said that he thought that it could not. I think that that's not exactly correct. The illegality defense could prevail on a cashier's check in two events. If, in fact, the person, let's say in the position of Mr. Parmet, had come in to the bank that issued the cashier's check and said, I gambled the proceeds of that check away. Would you please stop payment for me? And the bank said, no, I don't believe we will. And he said, well, I'll defend you. And then they said, yes, okay, we'll do that. We will dishonor the check. And then if they bring a lawsuit and you defend us, you can raise the illegality defense and defeat payment of that check. Even if the holder is a holder in due course. So I think that you could prevail on the illegality defense even with the cashier's check under certain factual circumstances. As far as certification goes, I think that I'd like to respond to your questions, Justice Cook, about whether this check was certified by debiting Alan Parmet's account. The only way that Guaranty Federal's check issued to Binnen & Company could have been certified is if somebody brought it into Citibank in New York and Citibank said, okay, I promise to pay this check when it comes through the system, and certified it. That would be certification of this check. The debiting of Mr. Parmet's account is not certification in these circumstances, and the certification statute is 3411 in the code, and that makes that clear that it's the drawee that does that. I think one of the most important things that came up is that Mr. Griffin's position is that these checks are cash equivalents because they are viewed by the public as being reliable and because of the reasons they are issued. And I must say, in our case at least, there is no evidence in the record of the reason that this check was issued. I mean, why at the time Mr. Parmet was after it, when it was issued. There wasn't any evidence given that he told Guaranty Federal why he wanted the check. In fact, the evidence was that there wasn't much said at all at that transaction.
Did you speak to the fact that the reason he canceled the check was because the initial check they gave you was the file?
Yes, because Mr. Parmet, for some reason, came back to Guaranty Federal the next morning and said, the check I gave you is no good. Therefore, Guaranty Federal, and this goes to one of the other points that was raised about Exhibit 5, I believe, the application for the check, imposing conditions on stop payment. Guaranty Federal had every good reason to disregard those provisions because it was the one that had the defense to the check. It didn't want to see that check paid by Citibank because it wasn't getting any money for that check. And that was a failure of consideration defense. But with respect to the cash equivalent, if I might take just 30 more seconds, Mr. Griffin has to concede that if the public perception changes, as Mr. Justice Heck suggested it might, maybe it has, about the value of savings and loans checks, then he has to concede that the law changes with it. And that cannot be the way that we enforce the laws of this state. The law is very clear, and the law should give rise to the understanding of the public and the custom and usage of the public in a case like this, and not the other way around. Unless there are any further questions about anything that I can answer.
Thank you
very much.
The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.